833-6503 or visit will.illinois.edu/Illinois Radio Reader. The Illinois Radio Reader is a service of Illinois Public Media.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. All month long, we've been featuring conversations about women in tech, and we've brought that conversation to Twitter using the hashtag NPRWIT. Today, we bring you a conversation with a woman who's broken many glass ceilings on her way to becoming the first female superintendent of the United States Air Force Academy. Lieutenant General Michelle Johnson's accomplishments are too numerous to list in this short space. She was a standout basketball star, the second all-time leading point scorer at the Air Force Academy. She was the first female Rhodes Scholar from the Air Force Academy. She served as NATO's Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations and Intelligence in Belgium in 2011. And in case you were wondering, she's also the mother of twins. And somehow she found time out to sit down with us, and she is with us now. Lieutenant General Michelle Johnson, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your service.
It's my complete pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much for asking me in.
Would you tell us how you became interested in a career in the military, and specifically the Air Force?
Right. Well, for those of us of a certain vintage, you remember the 70s, President Ford signed legislation in 1975 allowing women to attend the federal service academies. And when I was a teenager, I didn't necessarily follow that closely or realize the implications. But I did go to a career day at my high school in Spencer, Iowa, and a liaison officer from the academy said this possibility was there. My family really did not have a military background, but it seemed an opportunity to serve, but also to get a great education, but also to be able to play basketball, frankly, and to play at the college level, which wasn't so common back in the 70s.
You were a member of the Air Force's second class to enroll women to train for a career as an officer. Do you mind if we ask you what the environment was like, and were there ever moments when you wondered if you'd made the right decision?
I have to say yes to the latter, because it was a time of tremendous change. Time has given me the perspective to understand that people act out sometimes really hostily and violently regarding change. So when I entered the academy, I faced many people who questioned why people like me were here. And when we said for the same reasons anyone else comes, it was hard to understand. So it was a shock to me to come from being 51% of the population in Iowa to being a minority of about 10%. And so quite a reverse to what's in normal college demographics.
I wanted to ask you about that, because the class entering the Air Force Academy today, the class of 2017, about 24% are female, so of course the rest are male.
Right.
Most college campuses, women are at least equal, and in many, they are the majority, and they are the majority of people getting degrees. And I just wanted to ask you why you think it is that at your institution there's still such a distinct gender imbalance.
One of the things that's very eye-opening for people when they learn more about all the service academies, that includes West Point for the Army, Annapolis for Navy, and obviously Colorado Springs for the Air Force Academy, is that our accessions process looks more like the Electoral College than one linear order of merit. The way people come into the service academies is through congressional nominations, whether by the Senate or the members of the House. We look at diversity based on socioeconomic factors, as well as, you know, race, gender, age, nationality, and that sort of thing. And so we have about 30% of our cadet wing are people of color or minorities, and about 23% are women. And we cannot specifically target particular groups, but we can target underrepresented congressional districts and hopefully allow people, you know, a little bit like me, who maybe hadn't considered the possibilities of getting this great education, serve for 5 years, and get to see the bigger world and see something greater than themselves, and then go about their business if they want. Or if they're like me, they stay in much longer.
What difference does it make, do you think, to have that kind of representation? There are those who argue that it doesn't. As you mentioned, the selection process is very rigorous. It takes into account any number of factors. There are those who even question why we're having this conversation. So I'd like to ask you why you think it matters.
Well, life is co-ed, isn't it? And it's a big world out there, and we're dealing with very complex issues. We need every aspect of our national strength to really deal with these complex issues. I think in terms of leadership and being well-rounded, understanding our own motivations and talents and understanding those of others. That's why we find ourselves really valuing the humanities, the liberal education part of our education program, in addition to science, technology, and engineering and math, because a lot of our challenges are human challenges. It's about the human condition. And so we don't want to be daunted by the technology, but we need to also understand the people that go along with it.
I do want to talk a little bit more about STEM, if you would, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. I don't know if I mentioned that you are a pilot. So clearly, you have to have given some thought about the whole presence of women in STEM. Have you found that there are distinct approaches that are valuable in encouraging the kind of gender balance that you hope for?
Well, we're trying. I would offer to you, everyone that graduates from a service academy graduates with a Bachelor of Science degree, even if their major is in English. But what we do here is reach out. And so we have a STEM club at the academy, and the cadets themselves go out to the K through 12 schools in the local region, especially in southern Colorado here, and try to go out. And it has more impact when they go out because they're cool and young and hip and the kids can relate to them. I know I just said that about academy cadets, but they really are, in spite of our uniforms. They're just great young American kids, and they reach out with a chemistry magic show and bungee Barbie and many, many different approaches to try to make young people, especially girls, understand that it's fun and rewarding to do that line of work.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Lieutenant General Michelle Johnson. She is the superintendent of the United States Air Force Academy. She happens to be the first woman in that post. I am interested in this whole question of how women and girls integrate into the service. The military has long been held up as the most successfully racially integrated institution in our society, right? With women, somehow, it seems to be different. It's not a secret that you've come to lead the Air Force Academy at a time when the whole question of sexual assault in the military is very much a part of the national consciousness, certainly a part of the political consciousness. I want to drill down a little bit more on this whole question of the sexual assault piece per se, but it does seem to speak to an inability to accept women in these roles. I don't know how you see it.
Well, it is complicated, so thank you for seeing it that way and realize generationally, things that are different now than 37 years ago, the reactions to us were more overt and in your face and basically, hey, we don't want you. That's a different thing now because I find that there is mutual respect for accomplishment and for each other's dignity, which we want to emphasize. But what's different in the scenario is now the way people relate to each other, social media, the communication, this sort of interesting approach to privacy or not privacy. And at a certain point in watching television or getting off to one side or someone, maybe alcohol is involved sometimes, a line is crossed and someone is hurt by that. We have different scenarios. We have young people in situations where they would find themselves in residential dorms in other colleges. So we have this age group, 18 to 22, and they're finding their limits. And it's more of a disparity of understanding and exposure to the realities of what can happen if you're not respectful of the boundaries.
Hmm. There's a story that's very much in the news at the moment where a senior officer was having a longstanding affair with a junior officer on his staff. But just sticking to the whole question of the service academies, according to a report released in December from the Department of Defense, in the last academic year, there were 70 reports of sexual assault among the military academy, Naval Academy, and the Air Force Academy. And of those, 45 came from the Air Force Academy. I understand that it's a complex issue, but this has to weigh on you. And I'd like to ask if you feel that you are making any headway in addressing this.
Well, I think we are. But in all humility, it's hard to know what's out there because we've all said this is an underreported crime, and it's a crime indeed. The way we measure this probably makes it more difficult as well. Our reports went from 52 a year ago to 45 last year, but they include everything from hostile work environment, inappropriate comments, to physical assault. It's a big spectrum. The number of actual physical assaults is really small, but we don't want any. So we have tremendous numbers of presentations, formal presentations for the young people and for the active duty as well. And we'll actually have Sexual Assault Awareness Month in April, and have days where we stop doing the normal business and just talk about these kinds of matters. We have external speakers come in and just be pretty explicit about the scenarios. And what bystanders could do to stop some of these scenarios if they're just tuned into it. So we take it very seriously, and we're trying to be as transparent about it as we can.
Overall, I know that as a leader, as a pilot, as a graduate of the academy, that you set goals for yourself and you have benchmarks for accomplishment. I'd like to know how you will know if you've succeeded in this role. How will you judge yourself?
When the label we've put on this is trying to achieve a culture of commitment and a climate of respect, and I paint it in a broad way so that people can feel committed to something greater than themselves. And as you are probably aware, many, many national issues play out on our service academy front yards because we are a microcosm of our services. We embody the institutional characteristics of our greater services, and people watch us really closely in our language, the way we treat each other, in our diversity. Again, not just diversity of our physical appearance, but diversity of thought and backgrounds. If we can achieve a climate of respect where people, even with their differences, can feel comfortable raising their concerns within our system, then I'll think we'll have arrived at a climate. I don't know if we can ever get to zero, but I hope we're really close to zero reports of things that have happened, not because I don't want people to report. We want people to report, but because people would feel confident enough to let us know what's happening, and hopefully not much will be happening.
Lieutenant General Michelle Johnson is the superintendent of the United States Air Force Academy. She happens to be the first woman to hold that position. She was kind enough to join us from Colorado Springs, Colorado. General, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Just ahead, you've probably heard about Alzheimer's disease, but what you may not know is how dramatically it affects women. Women are far more likely to get it, far more likely to be the caregivers of people who have it, and there is no cure. We'll hear more myths and facts about Alzheimer's and the latest in our series about paying for college. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, some Ukrainian, Crimean, and Russian history that will help us understand what's going on today. We talk with Kimberly Martin, a professor of political science at Barnard College and deputy director for development at Columbia's Harriman Institute for Russian, Eurasian, and East European Studies. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 66 years. The Hendrick House dining facility, with Gold LEED certification, grows produce on its green roof and in its farm plot and supports local farmers. More information is available at hendrickhouse.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to turn now to a rite of spring, the wait for those college acceptance letters. Soon to follow for many will be financial aid packets that spell out grants, loans, and other awards. Now, that financial aid offers the promise of college to many who would otherwise not be able to afford it. But we know it can be very complicated. That's why, along with our colleagues at NPR's Morning Edition, we're spending some time this spring bringing you stories about paying for college. We want to help you navigate that higher education money maze. Now, previously, we talked about why college has gotten so expensive. Today, we're going to focus on those forms. Scott Judas is with us. He is Director of Student Financial Services at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. Scott Judas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Now, we looked up a number of sample award letters, and it seems like they're all different. Is that the way it is? Every college, every university has its own format?
It is. And that's actually one of the most confusing parts about sending out financial aid awards is they all look slightly different and they all have slightly different components to them. So sometimes families find that very confusing.
How would you recommend that you start? Let's say you're in the lucky position of having a number of awards. What's the first thing you should do?
So I think the first thing you should do is step back and first of all say congratulations, right, to either your student or yourself if you are the student, because it's been a long road to get here. And so you always want to take a step back, I think. But after you've done that and you're starting to figure out your financial aid award, what you don't want to do is focus solely on how much grant did I get or how much loan or even looking at the bottom line of the financial aid award letter. What you want to try and do is figure out what are my bottom line costs. And there are a number of ways that you can do that. But my suggestion would be to focus on cost versus the actual financial aid award.
Why?
So again, we have financial aid awards are different for each school, and they're going to be made up of different components. So some will be heavier in loans, some will have no loans, and also the price of each institution is different. So if you're looking at just the grant amount, at the final tally, the grant may not make the difference. It's the actual final cost.
Are there common mistakes that people make in filling out those applications that might lead them to not get the right amount of money?
There are some common mistakes that folks make. One of them is that when folks are filling out the financial forms, they don't actually understand what they're being asked. And so what they try and do is put, for instance, what they feel like they make. And so sometimes families either over or underestimate that. And when we verify that information, that can make a big change.
Well, I'm kind of puzzled by that. You know, I mean, people put down how much they think they make. And is that because a student is generally filling the form out and not the parent himself or herself?
It can be because the student is filling it out. And so oftentimes we find that families aren't talking. So they, you know, a student may be filling out the form and feel that they're solidly middle class and they think their family makes about $70,000 or about $100,000. So that's what they'll put down. And when in reality, that's not their actual situation on paper.
And you can see where that makes a huge difference.
Absolutely.
What about a situation since you went there about where the parents are not cooperative, where the student is an able student and the student has the qualifications to go to school. Perhaps that person is getting some support or help from college advisors at school, but the parents, for whatever reason, are not cooperative in filling out and being fully transparent about their finances. What do you do?
So that's a really difficult situation, and unfortunately, we find too many students who are in that boat. And one of the things that you can do is there's a way now that you can file the federal form and indicate that your parents aren't cooperating, and you can at least file the form. Unfortunately, it's not going to get you any federal funds outside of loans. And for most institutions that are awarding their own money, they're not going to accept that. So really, the student is going to have to do their best to get the parent to actually file the paperwork. Filing the paperwork doesn't mean that the parent is ultimately responsible. Coming up with the financing plan is something that can be done at a later date. But in order to determine financial aid eligibility, we at least have to start with what the parent's financial situation is.
Is there generally room to negotiate how much financial aid you get as a student, particularly if you're a student who's highly sought after?
Wow, that's a... That's a question that really spans the spectrum. So at some institutions, they do not allow for negotiating of financial aid awards. And usually those are institutions where their award is based solely on a family's demonstrated need. So if your family situation changes, that school may be able to change their financial aid award. But if it's simply, this isn't enough, or my parents don't feel they can pay this, that's usually not a reason. There are some other institutions out there that actively solicit financial aid awards from other places and say, we will match your award. Or perhaps your funding is based on a merit scholarship, in which case, a lot of times those will be negotiable as well.
And do you find that, you know, just this seems like a lot of marketplaces where the college and university has all the information, and the student, particularly if this is a first-time student going to college or somebody from a background where they don't have a lot of exposure, the student's really at a disadvantage. I mean, it just seems like one of those unbalanced marketplaces, right? So yeah. Is there anything that the student can do to kind of level the playing field?
I think that the student can do a number of things. And I think one of the first things that I would recommend is that the student be a partner, whether it be with their parents. Perhaps their parents don't have that experience and they haven't been to college themselves, or maybe they've been to college a number of years ago. And oftentimes families will feel, parents will feel that that's as much of a disadvantage. But for those students, particularly first-generation college students, where they may not have the support of their parents, the first thing those students need to do is educate themselves and to seek out the help. And so you point out a really good resource that so many students, I don't think, take advantage of, and that would be college resource officers. Maybe it's in their high school or with some community-based organizations. And this is a place where a lot of colleges have put a lot of time and effort in as well. So a number of outreach programs, so you should start with the colleges as well. And I don't think it's so much that institutions don't want to share the information, but there's some natural roadblocks that have to be overcome.
Like what?
So in our society, we don't tend to talk about financing very much or about money in general. And I think that that's a huge problem when it comes to financing college, because this is one of the financial milestones in a student's life. And yet, until this point in time, many of them have no financial training whatsoever. So they may shake their head, yes, I know the difference between loan and grant, when in reality, they don't have the understanding that a loan has to be paid back.
Hmm. So what's the most important thing you would like people to draw from this conversation?
I think to have a conversation with folks. So sounds a bit strange, but the conversation really has to start. And for many families, that can be with your parents. But as we've already noted, there are a number of students where that's not an option. But we need to connect them with the resources so that they can have that conversation and understand what their options are, so that it's not just the sticker price that you see on a website, or that you hear these private elite colleges are so expensive, or your only option is College X. There are a number of options out there.
Scott Judas is Director of Student Financial Services at Wellesley College in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and he joined us from there. Scott Judas, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
And just a reminder, you can weigh in with your own story or question on Twitter at #PayingForCollege. Now we want to turn to some new facts about Alzheimer's. A new report says women are hit hardest by this disease. Nearly 2/3 of people with Alzheimer's are women. And when it comes to caregiving, women are 2.5 times more likely than men to provide 24-hour care to somebody with Alzheimer's. This according to new research from the Alzheimer's Association. We wanted to know more about this, so we've called Angela Geiger. She's Chief Strategy Officer at the Alzheimer's Association. We caught up with her in Los Angeles. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Could you just remind us briefly what Alzheimer's is?
Alzheimer's is a progressive and fatal disease. Lots of people ask the question what the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia is, and dementia is actually the set of symptoms that you see, and Alzheimer's is the cause of most dementias.
You call it a public health crisis. Why do you call it that?
There are 5 million Americans with Alzheimer's disease. That number is set to spike to as many as 16 million by the middle of the century. And Alzheimer's disease is already the most costly disease in this nation. We simply cannot afford economically or the toll on families to not make progress in detection and treatment before those numbers spike.
Do we know what causes Alzheimer's?
Alzheimer's disease is the only one in the top 10 causes of death that we don't know how to treat, prevent, or even slow its progression. There's still many, many mysteries around Alzheimer's disease, and we need a lot more federal research funding to figure them out.
We mentioned that almost 2/3 of Alzheimer's patients are women. Why is that?
Well, the primary reason that more women than men have Alzheimer's disease is because women live longer. But there's also lots of questions that are still out there. There's well-known gender structural differences in the brain, hormonal differences, and one of those key research questions is to find out more about, is there something more than just lifetime risk?
We know that it's associated with advanced old age, but we don't really know what causes it.
Right. The greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is age, but we know there's it's a very complex disease, and clearly there's other things going on. And again, we just need more research to start to figure that out.
And I want to talk a little bit about caregiving. You're saying that women are much more likely to be primary caregivers to somebody with Alzheimer's. Why is that?
Well, you know, again, that's a place where there's probably societal issues around that. One of the things we do know that just happened in our Alzheimer's Association Women and Alzheimer's poll is that almost 40% of caregivers said they became a caregiver because they didn't feel like they had a choice. So there's a lot of women out there who are in their, you know, in that sandwich generation who are caring for aging parents as well as their kids at home.
And when you say that they didn't have a choice, it's because why? I mean, the cost of paying somebody to provide that care would be just so prohibitive that they just couldn't possibly, just can't afford it? Or is it that they feel that the person's needs are so demanding that they can't trust someone else to do it? Do you know?
You know, I think both things are true. You know, I get the opportunity to talk to families all across the country who are going through this Alzheimer's disease journey. Alzheimer's caregiving is really hard, particularly in the later stages of the disease where it requires real hands-on care for just, you know, eating, bathing, all those kind of things. So why people don't feel they have a choice is a variety of factors. It can be economic. It also may be a family choice, preference to keep someone at home or do that themselves, or other cultural factors also play a role of it. One of the interesting things we found in our recent poll was that women are 2.5 times more likely than men to do that really active hands-on care that happens at the end of those later stages of Alzheimer's disease. And it's very emotionally as well as physically taxing.
There are other things that you wanted to talk about in this poll, too, as I understand it, that you feel that people have a lot of myths about Alzheimer's that you wanted to dispel. Could you talk a little bit about that? Or what are some of the common misperceptions or misconceptions that people have about it? And what would you like people to know?
There are a lot of misperceptions about Alzheimer's disease, the most common being that people don't necessarily think of it as a disease. Alzheimer's is a disease of the brain, and it's progressive and ultimately fatal. In fact, it's the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. Most people don't know that. But one of the really interesting things that came out of the poll was that there's this strong misperception, it's a mistaken belief, that Alzheimer's has to run in your family for you to be at risk for Alzheimer's, and it's just not true. In fact, 24% of both men and women agreed with that. And then there were even bigger differences based on ethnicity.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. I saw that. I understood that there were some large ethnic differences in the misunderstanding that Alzheimer's has to be something that runs in your family in order for you to get it, that 33% of Hispanics polled thought that, and nearly half of the Asians who were polled by you thought that, and that is simply not true. That is, why do you think that is? Any ideas?
That actually was a really surprising finding for us, and it's made us really think about what kind of outreach and education we need to be doing at the Alzheimer's Association in different populations to help correct that myth.
Can I just clarify one other thing you said? It's the sixth leading cause of death in this country. How does one die from Alzheimer's? How does it cause death?
Alzheimer's causes death in a couple different ways. The most direct, when you die because of Alzheimer's, it's because your body, you know, everyone thinks about Alzheimer's and memory. You know, you forget things, you forget people. Well, ultimately, your body forgets how to do things, like eat and breathe. So your body eventually just shuts down because of the Alzheimer's disease. And then there's also lots of times that people die with Alzheimer's disease or because of Alzheimer's disease, because of a bed sores or a pneumonia or those kind of related things. But one of the interesting things about Alzheimer's mortality rates is that they're vastly underreported. That while Alzheimer's disease, you know, right now is the sixth leading cause of death, we know that many, many more people die from Alzheimer's disease than those official reports.
What is it that you are hoping to accomplish with this poll? I confess that normally we would not use a poll by an association because the assumption would be that it's kind of self-serving, that you're looking for what you hope to find, right? I mean, just to be honest about it. But this research demonstrates some patterns that I think are hard to ignore. I mean, you know what I mean? The findings are so overwhelming, it seems like it would be really hard to ignore the preponderance, you know, of evidence that, particularly on the gender balance question here and a number of these other factors. I mean, what is it the most important thing that you're hoping people draw from this information?
Yeah, this most recent poll really builds on the work that we originated back in 2010 with Maria Shriver and the Shriver Report. And so these trends have remained really true over time about this burden of Alzheimer's in women. And we thought it was time to go back out into the field and look and see what had changed. And what we found was in some cases things are even harder today for women when it comes to Alzheimer's disease than it was even a few years ago. And that's why we're launching a brand new women's initiative. We're asking 1 million women to go to alz.org/mybrain and tell us why her brain matters and how she's going to use it to wipe out Alzheimer's disease. We really think that women are smart and amazing and can solve big problems, and Alzheimer's is a public health crisis that must be solved.
Angela Geiger is Chief Strategy Officer at the Alzheimer's Association. She joined us from Los Angeles. Angela, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, a video that seems to show a father beating his 13-year-old daughter as punishment for misbehavior has gone viral. Some people are shocked. Other people say more Americans could stand to take a page from that book of discipline.
We come from a different disciplinary culture. In Uganda, it's being canned, you know, being spanked, you know, something like that. But here, it's a totally different matter where you have to give the child a time out.
Our parenting panel takes on the sensitive debate over whether physical discipline is ever okay to use on children. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, if you were a crayon, what color would you be and why? That's an actual question being asked in job interviews right now as employers become pickier than ever. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
On the next Community Cinema, the documentary film Medora takes a deeply personal look at small-town life in Medora, Indiana, following the high school's down-but-not-out varsity basketball team who struggles to compete parallel the town's own fight for survival. Join host Lindsay Moon for the free public screening and panel discussion at the Spurlock Museum on Tuesday, April 1st at 7 p.m. Free garage and street parking is available.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center which includes unique and independently owned specialty shops like the Art Co-op, Brownfield Sports, So Sassy, Wind, Water, and Light, and Your Nails.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today, we want to talk about a new video that's making the rounds on social media, and no, sadly, it has nothing to do with cute cats. According to the caption on the video, and we confess we have no way of knowing if this is true, the video is of a father hitting his 13-year-old daughter because she was gone from home for 3 days, and her parents didn't didn't know where she was. Now, I need to play a short clip from the video so you'll know what we're talking about, but I also need to let you know that the clip may be very difficult for some people to listen to, even though we're bleeping some of the language where someone, perhaps the person shooting the video, perhaps the mother, calls the girl the B word and a slang word for prostitute. So with that being said, here it is.
You 13, ho! You want to be a woman? Put it on Facebook, let them know. Video that hoe some noise. You know you ain't grown.
It goes on, but that's all we're going to play for now. And the video has received 4 million hits to date and thousands of comments, particularly on Black social media. Now, some viewers express outrage, but others, perhaps most actually, express support for the father. Now, as we said, we cannot confirm the family relationships, but the debate it has sparked about physical discipline is very real. So we wanted to talk about that. And joining us to talk about this is Isaura Gonzalez. She is a psychologist who works with children and families. She's also a mom of four. Dr. Gonzalez, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us, Lester Spence. He's one of our regular contributors. He's an associate professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University and a father of five. Lester, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us once again, Owen Kibenge. He's a freelance journalist who was born and raised in Uganda. He's a dad of one, and he has another on the way. Congratulations for that. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks.
So let's start with you, Lester, because we've talked with you about this before. The video was posted on the website World Star Hip Hop with the caption, "Father whoops on his 13-year-old daughter dressed like Beyonce after missing for 3 days." And I wanted to ask you what you thought of it. And I do want to mention that you've told us before that you have physically disciplined or spanked your own children.
Yes, I have. I was spanked, and I've spanked my kids up until probably they were probably somewhere between 7 and 9. I think, first of all, this is like a public flogging, right? I mean, there's disciplining your child, and then there's like public humiliation that gets, 4 million hits, and you can just imagine the economy that's generated around it. I mean, when I tried to look at the video myself, I had to look through an ad before I actually watched the video, and that's an economy there. So, and that's important because when you're talking about discipline, there are ways you can imagine whatever you think about whether physical discipline is right or not right for a child, bringing in the public aspect of it, literally 4 million viewers, that's 5 times or 6 times the population of the city of Detroit. You're talking about a very different dynamic, and is deeply, deeply problematic. Mm-hmm. Even as I kind of sympathize with the parents as far as having, if the video clip is right, for having a kid missing for 3 days, right? I don't know what I'd do in that situation, but I know what I wouldn't do.
Oh, and what about you? You were telling us that you grew up with physical punishment in Uganda. It's called caning there. We call it, switching or spanking or using a switch. Tell us your thoughts about this.
The video was despicable, to say the least. It's very unfortunate that she's humiliated in public. And I think that's not, when you do it in anger, then it ceases to be effective. My thinking is that if I'm going to cane someone or my son, or my daughter, or my nephews, or my nieces, it's a private matter, and I'm going to layer it with an explanation as to why I'm doing it, and I'm going to do it in private, and I'm going to let them know that you've done something wrong, and this is why I have to take on this measure.
Why do you think you have to do that? You've told us that you do use physical discipline. You were caned as a child, and
right.
I assume occasionally, use this method yourself. Why would you consider it necessary?
Because I come from two cultures. I have seen the American way of trying to discipline a child, the timeout and the withdrawal of toys and things like that. And I grew up in a society where I'm working at the entire day. I mean, I'm looking for firewood, or I'm going to graze the goats. And if you told me to have a timeout and go in the corner, I'm going to see that as I'm going to take a break on that. It's not going to be viewed as a punishment. So for me to employ the cane, it's the highest that I have amongst my several options for punishing a child. I'm going to start, and it's going to be incremental. In a situation where I tell you to do something and you keep doing the same thing over and over again, and I punish you and that doesn't work, I'm certainly going to employ the cane. And in this case, For me, I'll not employ the cane as it was employed on me. I'm going to use a slipper or a flip-flop because that's what I use, and I've used that on my son before, of course, against my wife's advice. She's totally against it. Right. Mm-hmm. She's totally against it, and she thinks that you can talk to the child. And her position is now informed by her graduate studies in early childhood and special needs education. And we have these arguments back and forth, and I tell her now, he has refused. What are we going to do about this? And she says, you keep talking to the child and give him timeouts and deny him time on TV and video games. But it keeps going on. And when I raise the subject and I tell him, you know what, I'm going to spank you, then I see results. And when I do it, that habit doesn't happen for a prolonged period of time.
Dr. Gonzalez, let's hear from you on this.
Well, I'm listening to both gentlemen, and you're bringing up some very valid points. You know, the speaker before me, what he's talking about in psychological terms, as you look at it, is power assertive or inductive. You know, and he tries to use a combination of both. Power assertive is where you employ some type of physical discipline. Or some harsh consequence for the behavior. And then inductive is where you set some limits. So he's actually combining the two. Most psychologists and most individuals in my field try to do more of the inductive. You set the limits, you set the parameters, you set the boundaries, and then there's a consequence for failing those boundaries. Again, I saw the video as well, and that wasn't, you know, in any terms, that would have been an assault. If that wouldn't have been the father, it wouldn't have been looked at as, you know, physically punishing the person, but rather an assault.
What stands out for you, for our guests, for Lester and for Owen, the thing that stood out to them was the public shaming. And so that was the thing that they see that felt was kind of over the top. I think for other people, it's the hitting and the wailing and the name calling. And I wanted to ask you as a psychologist, you know, what stands out for you?
Well, what Owen said, which I thought was very interesting, what stood out for me is the lack of coping mechanism for the father, because there are so many other avenues that you can actually take. You know, if he had a child who is out and about, you know, in the state of New York, we have the PINS petition, which is person in need of supervision. You utilize that when the parent no longer can appropriately exercise control within the home. The issue of the anger, for me as an executive coach, you know, which I deal with a lot on anger and emotional intelligence, shows to me that this individual really needs a lot of help in order to manage himself so that he can manage the home.
It's interesting because we're having a very kind of, you know, high level conversation about this, and it isn't really capturing like the feelings that I know that everybody has about this. This is an extremely emotional subject for a lot of people. I know that actually I'm personally struggling with my own emotions around this right now, to be really frank with you, because I'm just so upset to see a 13-year-old being hit this way, and I have to just own that. I just don't see how this is civilized. And so, you know, I apologize for that. The debate on social media around this is extremely emotional, too. And I just want to read some of the comments. And it's interesting, as I mentioned, that most people are supporting the father in this. I mean, well, some people say, well, you know, and also people point out the gender issue. Some people say that the thread would be completely different if it were a black mother, particularly a single mother beating her sagging pants son who'd been missing for 3 days. I don't know. What do you think about that, Owen? Maybe you should take that.
Yeah, I had the conflict. I said, if that was my daughter, would I take the same route? Mm-hmm. And I can't resolve it, but I still can't do that to her. Now, if it was my son, I don't know whether I'll still accept it, because it's still humiliating and it's going to have effects down the road. He's going to probably have issues with his self-confidence, because that's what it created in me. I could not challenge authority, because I've always thought that whenever I challenged authority, I was beaten, especially in class, mm-hmm. in school. So it has taken me time to outlearn and come out of that shell where I can confront authority and be assertive. So and if it's done in public, that's totally unacceptable, because how is she going to go back into the community? And whenever she sees this video when she grows up, how is she going to feel about her parents? So,
well, that's a question that a lot of people raise. In fact, let me just read a couple of the other comments that there were on the route of the the website, The Root, the online publication, talked about this. One person wrote, no, this is slave mentality. This is a master beating his property to make them do what the master wants them to do. If the child is not violent now, the odds are she will be in the future. And but other people said, look, this may seem too far to people, but this is needed to keep kids in line. When I was young, I did not do a lot of things I wanted to do in fear of a beating, so it does work. I plan on doing the same to my kids, but it won't be on YouTube. So Lester, why don't you pick up the thread here? I mean, there are people who argue that, look, this is just replicating an unhealthy relationship with authority. And yes, it's terrifying, and clearly there's something else going on in the home that a kid goes missing for 3 days. But so your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so there's a dynamic with black sexuality here where I've seen a number of videos, and one of the reasons, and to be fair, one of the reasons why I'm responding more to the public showing than the beating itself is because, to be honest, I didn't look at all of it. Because I don't feel comfortable. I don't think it's right. I think it's very voyeuristic, and I can't do it.
You feel like in a way you're complicit by watching.
Yes, yes. So I knew what it was. I knew the genre. I'm like, okay, I'm not gonna look at it, right? But there's this black sexuality dynamic going on where whenever I see those clips, I have never seen a clip like that with a boy child being beaten. I've always seen public humiliation of black girls. Either they're being spanked, or in this case, being beaten, or something else, because they're performing their sexuality. Now, it's complicated, right? Because black boys and black girls are surveilled differently by the public, right? So we have to. So part of the reason why I used physical discipline, and I really appreciate what Owen said about anger and about explaining the consequences. That's exactly what I did. But part of it was because, okay, if I don't show them what can potentially happen, then they're going to be treated a very different way than their white counterparts when they get into the world. Mm. But at the same time, quickly, it's also about giving them the space to actually explore themselves or explore it. So when they get in the world and they need to stand up for themselves, they're able to do so. And this kind of cuts both of those things.
If you're just joining us, it's our weekly parenting conversation. We're talking about using physical discipline with children. This conversation was sparked by a video that's now gone viral. It's had more than 4 million hits to date. It's of a person who is believed to be a father hitting his 13-year-old, a girl who's believed to be his daughter, because the caption says she went missing for 3 days and she comes home scantily clad. And we're talking about this with journalist Owen Kabengi, Professor Lester Spence, and psychologist Isaura Gonzalez. And, you know, Isaura Gonzalez, let's talk a little bit about the culture question. Lester, I do have to just say one thing. We have seen some videos of boys being beaten by people who are supposed to be male family members because they were acting thuggish. So there is that piece. But I understand what seems to really get the attention are these ones. But what about this cultural question sort of at the heart of this? A lot of parents of color say, look, the consequences for my children misbehaving are more harsh than for white kids or for privileged kids. So I have to be more strict and I have to be more physical. And that's just the unfortunate way it is. And so what do you say to that?
Well, when you look at it, a lot of parents feel that they've lost control. You can raise your kid in your home and you know what you're delivering at home, but you don't know necessarily what you're delivering when you take them to school or who they're going with. So a lot of times parents feel that they're out of control. And a lot of times they use, you know, in Spanish, la chancleta, the slipper, you know, or they threaten the spoon that's hanging on the kitchen wall, you know, the nice, that's supposed to be decorative. They'll say, I'm going to take the spoon and I'm going to get you with the spoon. A lot of times parents don't mean that, but they have no other sense of control or coping mechanism. They don't know what else to do because everything around them is so powerful for these children, especially with social media. If you look at social media, you know, all the kids are on the phone. They've got the computer. They've got all these games. There's Facebook. There's Twitter. There's so much influence nowadays that we didn't have before. It was a different type of influence. So parents now, especially with our cultures, feel that they have no control over this, that if they were back in our countries, that they would be able to control this a little bit better. So a lot of times that's what you begin to see is this feeling of being ineffectual, as being a parent who can't discipline their child. A lot of times also what I've seen with teachers is that they tell them, your parents can't hit you. And so parents also then feel that they don't have the power to discipline their child.
Oh, and I'm going to give you the final word here, because you were mentioning that you put these questions out on Facebook with your followers, too, a lot of people who come from the diaspora as well, and you're having this debate within your home as well with your wife, who has a different perspective on this. I'd like to ask you, where do you think this debate's going to go from here?
I think it's the option of canning or switching, like you said, right, is going to remain on the table for most African families that are coming from Africa to the United States and living here, and I'm sure so for most African American families as well, and probably Hispanic families. I think that option is going to stay on the table, but it's not going to be to the extent of humiliation like we're seeing there. That might have been right in the video in a couple of years ago it could have been right, but that's really unacceptable today. And I think parents are going to have a rich mix of options to be able to punish their children. I mean, deny them video games and deny them time going out. But then at the end of it, like she says, if you set limits and boundaries, as Dr. Gonzalez says, if those boundaries and limits are exceeded, what happens next? As a parent, my option, if those limits and boundaries are exceeded, as a parent, the option I have is to use a flip-flop.
Well, I think we'll probably be talking about this again. So Owen Kabenge is a freelance journalist. He was born and raised in Uganda. He's a father of one, another on the way. Thank you for joining us. Lester Spence is an associate professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, a father of five. Isaura Gonzalez is a psychologist in private practice and a mom of four. Thank you all so much for speaking with us.
All right. Thanks, Michelle.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.